academics, venture capital investors, a U.S. congressman, and several of the people you'll meet in this book. It would have been ironic if these people, most of whom, in some form or another, are paid to assess risk and uncertainty, had been ignorant of the coronavirus threat. But we were pretty worried. We all had the sense that this was the last time in a while that there might be this sort of get-together. Did any of us actually do anything about it, though? Not really. It's not even clear that the conference should have been held in the first place. A Biogen conference in Boston a week earlier had turned out to be a super-spreader event. I remember returning to New York City after the conference, and Mayor Bill de Blasio telling people to avoid using the subway. Those of you who don't live in New York might not grasp quite how vital the subway is. Telling a New Yorker to avoid the subway is like telling a fish to avoid swimming. And yet, offices, schools, bars, and restaurants were still open. There were still basketball and hockey games at Madison Square Garden, and crowds of tourists still thronged every major landmark in the city. So, on balance, the coronavirus was less a failure of prediction and more a failure to act upon expert guidance that, although it got a lot of details wrong and came with plenty of uncertainty, also got most of the big, directional stuff right. Most of this book deals with why expert predictions often go wrong, along with what can make for more reliable forecasts. But since The Signal in the Noise was published in 2012, there have been an increasing number of cases like these, where experts actually posited a fairly high probability of world-changing events, only for these forecasts to be largely ignored or misunderstood. In other words, making a good forecast is one thing, and convincing people to take it seriously is another, especially if the chance is under 50%, but meaningfully higher than zero. Like, say, a 28.6% chance that Trump would be elected president. I don't remember that much from Election Day. I remember voting, with voters in my super blue district of Chelsea, Manhattan, tossing nods and smiles to one another, perhaps thinking they were electing the first woman president. I remember getting into the 538 office at 5 p.m. It's a long night, so you want to take the morning off, and seeing exit polls that showed Hillary Clinton way ahead. While our model had Clinton favored, a 72.4% chance for her, a 28.6% chance for Trump, we had spent a lot of time trying to convince people that Trump really had a shot, that the 28.6% was real. Maybe it had been much ado about nothing after all. Then, I remember, at some point around 9 o'clock, the New York Times' upshot needle started to jitter toward Trump. In one swing state after another, Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan. Clinton's numbers were coming up just a little bit short of where she needed to be. I remember how the office was very quiet, how time seemed to slow down between when it became obvious that Clinton was probably going to lose and when the election was formally called for Trump, at around 2:30 in the morning. Frankly, I remember feeling prescient when I realized that Clinton was likely to win the popular vote despite losing the Electoral College. It was precisely the sort of scenario we had been warning about. No, our model hadn't called the outcome exactly. But our model doesn't make calls. It deals in probabilities. And it had assigned a much higher probability to this sort of outcome, Trump winning the Electoral College because white working-class voters broke toward him in the Midwest, than other forecasts did. I remember driving up to Hyde Park, New York, on a cold, dreary Sunday after the election, trying to gain some perspective, and visiting the FDR National Historic Site. I remember wondering if the U.S. was in for a long, tumultuous decade, like it had been in the Great Depression and through World War II. I spent weeks rereading mainstream media coverage of the election in the New York Times and other outlets for a series of essays on 538 that would later become The Real Story of 2016. Even though the polls were actually fairly tight toward the end of the race, any sign that Trump might win, like, say, that he was leading in polls of traditional swing states, such as Ohio and Iowa,